offered. I will also mention other projects with other collaborators. I mentioned the name going on. So here's a brief outline of the talk. First of all, I want to just make a simple point that whenever we consider long-distance motivation dynamics, such as a lot of talks in this conference, in some sense, thinking about scalar tensor theory is just generic. So I want to make that point. And number two, because of that also, you need to screen somehow the scalar on small scales. It's mandatory in order to be consistent with solar system tests and so on. Number three, I want to consider actually a very old question. How do things move? What is the motion of not just test particles, but actually microscopic objects like stars, galaxies, and so on? And in particular, do they all fall at the same rate, i.e., is the equivalence principle obeyed or not? And lastly, I'll talk about how to actually test the predictions of these screening mechanisms. In particular, interestingly, there are not even small, not even suppressed, but order one violations. But you have to look at the right ones. And I'll talk about what those right cases are. Let me start by just giving probably an incomplete list of all the long distance modifications of gravity that people have thought about. The first one is the most trivial, is F of R, or generalizations thereof. You can always recast it as scalar tensor theory, just gathering variety of scalar tensor theory, as shown by Shiba. And then in the next three categories, they are all related to DGP, we have heard about. The brain bending mode, in some sense, is the scalar tensor theory. It's the fact that the brain can have fluctuations in its locations, and, or its extrinsic curvature, if you like. And as shown by Luthi, Varadi, and Ratasi, you can actually write as a scalar tensor theory. In fact, it is a scalar tensor theory if you take a small wavelength limit. Basically, this pi that I was discussing just this time. Related to that is massive gravity that was discussed. If you do Stackelberg, you can introduce the scalar. You see, actually, there is a scalar in theory. And likewise, this filtering or the gravitational idea that Justin talked about, again, if you do Stackelberg, like was done in Justin's talk, you also see it. Basically, in all these cases, at least in the limit, in the high K limit, it really does look like a scalar. And then there are other examples. My colleague economists have found actually 4D generalizations of DGP with these non-trivial interaction terms, generalizations of them that are have a nice property that they are ghost-free and they give you self-acceleration. And then ghost condensate, I won't talk very much about. This is the last item is something I know the least about, but the authors of that idea is here. I don't know whether it's fair to put it under this category of scalar tensors.
Yes,
comments.
It is.
Okay. Very good. Before I move on, I want to actually make some side remarks just to make the discussion a little bit interesting. I think I'll skip the first one. I'll put it in a second. I want to actually, I'm not sure if it's a noble theorem. I'm not sure I can prove it, but maybe you can help me either prove it or kill it. Hopefully, you can kill this. That would be nice. So I want to go back to this idea of basically having some filtering mass, like what Justin talked about. So this would be just the linearized Einstein equation with a fierce Pauli mass term, except that the mass is not a constant, but an operator of some sort. So that's why M square box. If you take this equation, clearly you take derivatives. Let's say you just take two derivatives. This, in fact, just first derivative makes the first guy vanish, it's just Bianchi identity. You can see clearly what you have is that if you have conservative unit, what you have is basically the first order Ricci curvature is just zero. What that means is actually in all this the gravitation or filtering or resonance gravity idea, basically the curvature is set to zero period, independent of wavelength. And to see why that occurs, you do a Stubblegrub, and you actually see that as a scale tensor theory is none other than a branch leaky theory where the scalar is auxiliary, there's no kinetic term on its own. In fact, it's just a Lagrange multiplier. And so it's not surprising that you derive it, because you have a Lagrange multiplier that enforces curvature to zero. And you can see basically some kind of Branch-Hilbert theory with Branch-Hilbert omega is zero. And we know that that is by itself is not okay. It strongly violates solar system tests. To make it slightly less trivial, if you make a conformal transformation, so this is would be the Jordan frame, metric perturbation, this is would be the Einstein frame one. You go up, go to Einstein frame, it looks something like this. The scalar field does have a healthy kinetic term of its own, and matter would couple with this scalar field. And in this perspective, if you look at how the gravitation works in this perspective, it works basically because of the cancellation. If you put T here, if you put something like a cosmological constant, it would generate the Einstein frame metric would have basically this expansion. And if you expand around Minkowski, it's basically an x-squared profile. And the scalar field, the equation of motion is just something like this. And if T is a constant, they also have an x-squared profile. It's just a cancellation between the additional Einstein frame metric and the scalar field that give you a Jordan frame metric that is just flat, has zero curvature. That's more or less how it works, at least at the level of linearized equation of motion. And I think this is a point. This is a point that was actually made in Justin's paper as well. If you think about this, then it seems you have some kind of a problem. Because on the one hand, you know you need screening in order to have an acceptable theory. Because this theory by itself has Branch-Hilbert omega equals zero. It's not acceptable. It doesn't satisfy solipsism tests. So you want to screen, for example, by the Wallenstein mechanism, which I'll talk a little bit more about. On the other hand, for this screening not to mess up the gravitation, why do you want to preserve this expert profile? You basically need what you want to add is probably higher derivatives, more than two derivatives, in order for this profile to be preserved. And that necessarily should be these girls. And I'm not sure if this is a good enough argument to make the idea not so attractive. I don't know.
It's true that in our paper we looked at the at this case, and we actually did the decoupling limits, and went beyond just linear theory.
Yes.
And indeed, the statement you're making is how we got this bounded alpha less than half.
Right.
But it's true that all these theories, because their field is polyform, they have a close.
Yes.
So I agree with you.
Well, if the previous polyform doesn't necessarily have close, right? For example, VGP is polyform.
Yeah, it's not exactly VGP, right.
Right.
Once you go beyond linear, then.
That's basically, my question is. You know, is it something that's really a firm statement we can make that if you want to preserve the degradation idea, you cannot simultaneously make the theory consistent with solar system tests and it goes free. Maybe it's just too hard. I don't know.
Can I ask you any quick question?
I have two comments to local and Lorentz invariant. And then probably that we difference about.
So here I'm not resisting one. M square can be anything.
That's not so strongly non-local, so to speak. But you know, probably Lorentz invariant background is the key. If you mess with some of that, maybe you can relax. I mean, what I'm saying is it's just not known.
But maybe the cascading model that you have maybe it will turn out to be a context. I just want to throw it out there to generate some discussions.
So can I ask it's technical, but maybe not important question. So the mass term disappeared somehow from. So,
strictly speaking,
phi is can only normalize, and it's phi over m that's being shifted.
Sorry?
So your conformal transformation should be probably phi over m.
It's phi over m, so this.
But
this
it doesn't appear in the equation of motion.
Yeah, so I was thinking, when you do Stubblegrub, you should do basically H mu goes to H mu plus the mu phi divided by m squared.
Oh, sorry, right. So, yeah. Sorry.
Once you do that, you don't actually need an m in the control.
Okay.
Here you have an one.
So the answer is that there are ghosts.
That it seems hard to get around, although maybe there are ways to get around.
But a thing that's certainly non-negotiable is if the energy is not down in some flow.
This is fine. This is unitary. It's fine.
No. But if you have more than two time derivatives.
So
then there's no all the theories don't do not have energy which is bound.
Yes, you have ghosts and so on. So this
ghost is not quite the same thing as energy nothing bound. They often come together.
Yes,
but I mean there used to be heroic ideas about getting rid of the ghost, but breaking positive energy theorem seems to be too strong with positive
energy. Right. Yeah, I just want to add, in these ideas where, let's say, I try to realize this idea, like in dimension two frame, like a string, where you put tension on the string and create deficit angle, is it conceivable in that case if you apply it in terms of an effective body theory, if you effectively also have something like phi that plays the role of the branch multiplier, is that what is the negative in the string? I think that would be an interesting question to so just after this time, let me just go back to this point. Right? So I make this list of many different theories out there, and they are all scalar tensors of some form. And probably it's not an accident because of the theorem by Weinberg that a low energy, a Lorentz invariant theory of masses thin to particle must be true. And therefore, if you want to modify gravity at low energies, either you add new degrees of freedom, for example, you add a scalar, or you make the graviton massive, which turns out also introduce a scalar via Heisenberg, or you violate Lorentz invariance. One example of that is compensate, which is endless. So it seems some form of scalar tensor theory is valid. And just to add one more remark to this, in case, I don't think anybody in this room actually thinks that way, but in case anybody thinks modified gravity is somewhat exotic, I would say it's probably more exotic than quintessence in some sense, because epsilon symmetries, quintessence should be coupled with the gravitational trend. And that's basically what it's going to do. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, from a quantum gravity point of view, what's disappointing about everything collapsing on scalar tensor theories is there's no symmetry. Tensor scale, there's no symmetry that protects the scalar field from being very heavy and decoupling. And so then you're left with nothing interesting in the infrared.
Yes. So having a very light scalar field itself is a problem. But it seems in all these proposals, unless you just accept the cosmological constant as the explanation for constant acceleration, involves some light scale. Quintessence modified gravity.
Except for Kaskuta.
I thought you agreed with me sometimes.
But it's no, it's not.
Oh, you should have disagreed. Oh. That was a bad and also the unimodular gravity, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
It's all outside of all this.
Okay.
Since we're into exceptions.
Sorry, I started.
Yeah. You really started something, really. I have an exception in my theory.
Okay.
It says you have to put in a potential. Price figure doesn't have a V of phi.
Right.
When you put that in all the other things in my theory, yes. It becomes unstable.
Okay. So suddenly when I talk about scalar tensor theory here, I'm reading in general scalar tensor, including those with potentials. What we want ideally is a scalar that's somehow alive by a light basically is a small mass long range on large scale so that we modify gravity on top of scale by order one. That's what we want. And we modify gravity to explain acceleration. On the other hand, the scalar must be suppressed on small scales to match solar system tests. And at present there are two known screening mechanisms. One is Hamiltonian, the other is strong coupling or Bose-Einstein. Both of them make use of self-interactions of the scalar. One uses potential, chameleon, Vue uses basically derivative interactions in strong couplings. So let me just briefly go over them. The chameleon screening was pointed out by Justin and Amanda Wellman. And basically the idea, I don't think I want to go through the math, but the main idea is to give the scalability of max, and the mass that depends on the environment. And so roughly speaking, let's just look at it in Einstein frame. If you have potential for the scalar field that looks like this, my scalar field is 5. In Einstein frame, my matter is coupled to the metric B, a conformal factor that depends on the scalar field. And so the effective potential that the scalar field sees is a sum of the self-interacting potential and a linear piece, which is basically goes like the trace of T here is basically rho for non-relativistic matter, that's 5. So in a low density environment, this line has very shallow slopes, so 5 has large breadth and small mass. In high density environment, it has high mass. So that's more or less the idea, without going through the details. And so when you are in an environment like Milky Way, the scalar field just has a very short range. That's the idea. The other idea is to screen by strong let me use DGP as the example. So if you take DGP, you expand around Minkowski space, and you take the small wavelength and it's the Hubble. The Lagrangian is here, where phi is basically the same as pi. That was in Justin's talk. And this is the interaction term. So this is the non-trivial interaction term, which at first sight looks dangerous, but if you work out the equation of motion, it turns out it doesn't contain more than 2 derivatives. This would be the regular linear term. This is the term from the interactions. It doesn't have ghost. And what these interactions do for you is, if you, let's say, stick in a source here, let's say the sun, if you work out the profile of the scalar field, at large distances, you're dominated by this term, and phi has a 1 over r behavior, as usual. But at small distances, you're dominated by this term, and you just use just dimensional reasoning tells you 5, instead of going like 1 over r, we go by square root of r, close to the source. And so 5 becomes suppressed. And the transition scale between the two is known as the Einstein idea. And it's typically very large, actually, compared to the Schwarzschild radius. Little m here can be thought of as the graviton mass, basically typically Hubble scale. And so this is how strong coupling screen is there. So these are the two known screening mechanisms on the market.
In this theory, you put in a massive vector field, so it reduces gravity as you put it on a smaller scale. Perhaps it's a screening.
Did you introduce a massive vector field?
Yeah, it screens, it's repulsive. Reduces gravity as you go into the solar system.
Yes.
You get a cream of all solar system data. So you can add that in there.
So it's a scalar vector tensor field. I see. Okay. The questions I want to ask is the following. How do objects actually move under these screening mechanisms? That's the question. Now, naively, one would think the answer is just very simple. It's obvious. Because you can always rotate the geometric frame. And therefore, objects should just move on GOT physics in general, where the matter is minimally coupled to the metric. So if I write in linearized form, the matter action is just a coupling between the graviton and the tuning wheel of the matter, where this coupling is minimal, so your tuning wheel should just move on GOT. Or if you like, you can also rotate the Einstein frame, written in this form. But I would say, well, hang on a second. This statement might be true for test particles, for small particles, but is it true for extended objects? Is it guaranteed? And here I want to recall the fact that even in Newtonian gravity, it's not guaranteed. Extended objects like the sun, for example, does not necessarily move like a test particle. They only do if we ignore what is called tides, if you think about it. So Newton, if you read Principia, you actually spend a lot of time justifying the fact that the motion of the Earth around the Sun, and be calculated by us by basically approximating this the Earth as Tesla, 0.9. And that is a very good approximation because the Earth has a size that is small compared to basically the scale of pi. In other words, the second derivatives of the gravitational potential from the Sun, there's a scale associated with it. That scale is much larger than the Sun. Otherwise, strictly speaking, the pi should couple to, for example, the spin of the sample. We will, of course, work in the same zero pi approximation. So I'm not going to actually worry about this effect, which in practice usually is very small. So I'm not going to include tides here, but let me just remind you, it's not guaranteed even in Newtonian gravity that extended objects move like test particles. And let me give you kind of a first an intuitive reasoning and then some more quantitative derivation. And it's best, actually it's easiest to think about this problem in Einstein frame rather than German frame. So let me remind you, in Einstein frame, this is the Einstein frame metric, this is the scalar field, this is the mu nu. Your matter couples to both. So what basically happens is you really have you have a fifth force. The scalar field mediates it is light along each fifth force. Now at the level of this action, if you look at it, there's no equivalence principle violation visible at the level of the microscopic action. In fact, this the action is constructed so that there's no equivalence principle violation. So I want to distinguish what I'm going to talk about next with the kind of equivalence principle violation that's most often discussed in the literature, where phi, for example, is coupled to, let's say, tumulus of baryon or tumulus of electron or tumulus of dark matter with different strings. And of course, there, from the very beginning, you have violation of the equivalence principle. That's not what I'm going to talk about. So here, in these theories, at least by construction, at the level of the microscopic action, there's no such violation.
So the distinction is between weak equivalence principle and strong equivalence.
In a sense, yes. In a sense.
You're testing strong equivalence.
It depends on, it actually depends on which frame you're looking at. It's a little bit confusing question. But here, in what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to use basically the experimentalist definition of the equivalence principle violation. If I drop an apple and a watermelon, do they fall the same way? That's it. If they don't, then I'll say equivalence principle violation. That's all I mean. Here it is. So back to this point. Just reiterate a little bit, because the scalar field is by construction universally coupled, so there's no equivalence principle violation at the level of the gap. Now let's think about how a microscopic object would actually interact with this scalar field. If you write down some kind of action for some microscopic object that's moving along, tau would be the proper time according to the object, and this Q would be the scalar charge. So whatever scalar charge that this microscopic object carries, that is going to determine its coupling with phi. That's going to determine how it responds to, let's say, some gradients in phi in the scalar field. And that's one very well-known effect called Nordberg effect. It dated back to the 60s, where there's certainly equivalence principle violation of a particular sort, which is also not what I'm going to emphasize, but let me actually talk about it. It's very straightforward. The scalar charge, if you think about it, must be some volume integral of the trace of T. It more or less just follows from here, going this step. And if you look at an object that's very compact, so it's very relativistic, then what happens is basically the trace of T goes to zero. Therefore, for that object, the charge to mass ratio would go to zero. The most extreme example of that is, of course, a black hole. So that's basically the statement that a black hole has no scalar hair and therefore no scalar charge. And therefore, if you compare the motion of a black hole and a star like the Sun and ask, well, how would they move in the gravitational field of the galaxy, for example, they are going to fall at different rates because the star sees an active fifth force unsuppressed, whereas the black hole doesn't see the fifth force at all, zero charge. so it doesn't couple to the fifth force. In this game. So this, yeah.
So neutron star black hole binary would have very different systematics than a neutron star
yeah. Instead of fancy theory. That's right.
Can that be used?
Yes, people have done that calculations, for example, Clifford Whale and collaborators. So the orbital evolution of a binary that involves two black holes, let's say, or black hole neutron star compared against the would be different. And that's interesting for calculating, you know, what you expect for progression waves. Yes. So the orbits will be different. On top of that, if you have scalar tensor theory, you have more than just quantum radiation also. So there are several effects that are interesting there. This is also very well known. It's not what I'm going to focus on. So let me just describe this event a little bit further.
This is not chameleon effect.
This is not chameleon. This is not what I'm going to focus on. I just want to put it out there because it's known for a long time. And I want to contrast with chameleon. It's not chameleon. This has to be there, whether chameleon is there or not. Any scalar tensor theory will have this feature. So this feature is common to DGP, and DGP you will have this feature also. Strong chameleon. If you think about this effect, the Northbound effect, in the sense of a post-Newtonian expansion, it's actually a 1 over c squared effect rather than quarter 1 effect. In the following sense, that the departure of the charge to mass ratio from unity is roughly determined by what fraction of the mass comes from gravitational binding energy of the object. If the object like a black hole, the mass is completely gravitational in origin, then the charge to mass ratio would be 0. Whereas a regular star, the charge to mass ratio would be close to 1. And so this effect is in some sense suppressed by basically, if you like, the depth of the gravitational potential. And so it's a 1 over c squared effect in the parlance of post-Newtonian expansion. So you will only see large effect if you compare a very compact object with a regular star. If you compare two stars, the effect would be very suppressed. Phi is suppressed, where phi is the gravitational potential.
You have for a star, you have q equal to m.
Yes, roughly speaking, to very good approximation. It's 10 to minus 5.
The electromagnetism, which charge cannot equal the mass, not proportional to mass.
Yes.
Because charge is conserved.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only have that if charge is not conserved.
Yes, this here.
Fractional proper, charge is not conserved.
Here, there's no symmetry that gives you charge conservation. In fact, that's exactly why I'm going to use that charge is not conserved.
No, it's not.
For chameleon mechanism. That's how it works.
That affects what you're doing.
Yes, that's precisely the effect I'm talking about. That is not conserved in some theories. It turns out it's conserved in other theories. Let me just go there. So to this effect, the Northbound effect, which is 1 over c squared, let me add a more recent incarnation. If you like, of equivalence principle violation, which is due to chameleon screening, which is that with chameleon mechanism, there could be order 1 equivalence principle violation. And essentially, what happens is that in this theory, the scalar charge of a macroscopic object like a star actually get classically renormalized. If you like. And that renormalization is order 1 even for a regular object, an object that's not even compact. Like a star, or like the Earth, or a galaxy. And that is really what distinguishes the size of the effect from basically the more well-known Northbound effect. In the language of post-Newtonian expansion, this is not even post-Newtonian, it's just Newtonian. It's all one. Now, how does that come about? The easiest way to think about it is that if you look at an object where the scalar field is heavy, and it's something that is explained very nicely in Justin's paper on chameleon mechanism. If you look at an object, let's say this is a star, and let's say the star is sufficiently dense, then the scalar field inside it is massive. Therefore, the scalar field is short range. And you ask the question, what is the scalar profile outside this star? Well, the scalar profile should be sourced by, in principle, by all the mass inside the star. But now, the scalar field inside the star has very short range. And therefore, you know, a little element here inside the star will not source any scalar field outside. It will just be very highly suppressed. Let's say I'm interested in the scalar field out here. And so, if I'm out here, the only scalar field I will see would be the scalar field sourced by stuff within what Justin and Amanda call a thin shell of material at the surface, at the boundary of the object, where the width of this shell is more or less the quantum weight of the scalar field. So the scalar field, as seen by an observer outside, is much suppressed. It has an amplitude which is much smaller because instead of being sourced by a whole star, they're sourced by basically a small fraction of the mass. And therefore, the charge, the mass ratio of this object, is becomes very small. If you like, it's kind of like a renormalization of the charge, except it's not even quantum, it's just plus. The charge gets renormalized. The effective charge that you see from the outside becomes small when you have Hermitian screening. And so now if you compare two different objects, let's say this is an object that is green, meaning this object interior to it, the scalar field has a large mass, compared to an object where the scalar field continues to have very small mass throughout the object. So I call this an unscreened object. The charge to mass ratio now for this object is actually at around 1. This is going to 0. They are going to fall at different rates. Yes? So if you have a big truck that is green and a little orange that's kind of green, you drop them, they are going to fall at different rates, and the difference is all the 1. It's not 1 of the C squared. And this is easier to see, as I said, in Einstein's brain. This is kind of an intuitive argument. If you want to make that more rigorous, so here's how you do it. Let me skip this line. But let me just mention one thing. So whether an object is green or not, so don't pay attention to all this equation. Just look at this. This is the scalar profile of an object here as viewed from outside. The scalar profile is more or less gm over r. Alpha is the coupling of the scalar field to matter. Epsilon here describes basically screening. If the object is green, epsilon is very small. If the object is green, epsilon is close to 1. And the size of epsilon is determined by just one thing, which is the depth of the gravitational potential of the object. So an object with the gravitational potential that is actually sufficiently deep compared to basically the scalar field value outside, divided by what I call alpha. Alpha is the coupling, the dimensionless coupling between scalar and matter. If this is true, then you have screen objects. If this is false, then you have unscreen. So it's completely determined by the gravitational potential of the object. This is all worked out in Justin's paper. Now, how do we actually formalize this intuitive reason? Just put this on some of Fermi ground. And we found the nicest thing to do, the easiest way to do this, is to use actually a very old formulation developed by Einstein and collaborators, and was later actually developed by De Moore and others. And the idea is actually very simple, to turn the problem of motion of a large object into basically the computation of the surface integral of the flux. So more or less the idea is this, yeah? I have an object at mass m. Let me draw a sphere enclosing the object. Let me call that sphere s. The momentum of this object is of course given by a volume integral of di0, where di0 is the pseudo-energy momentum tensor. And the pseudo-energy momentum tensor is conserved in the ordinary sense. And therefore, I can use ordinary conservation, the rate of change of momentum, I can just take a time derivative using conservation and rewrite the spatial derivative, and then using Gauss law, I rewrite the surface integral. And it's not surprising that the gravitational force, the rate of change of momentum, is just the surface integral momentum flux. And yeah, this is basically just what I just said. Why is this useful? This is very useful because then you can figure out the motion of an object without thinking about the internal forces of that object, which is usually a complicated calculation. If you read actually Newton's original derivation, he has to think about the internal forces of the object, how they cancel each other, basically via Newton's third law and so forth. But if you think of it this way, you don't have to actually worry about it. All you have to do is to compute, find out the momentum flux at this surface. And the surface could be actually make it out if you want to. Make it far away from the object if you want to. So that everything is weak field, even as the object may be even something as convex. Doesn't matter. It's perturbative as so long as you make the surface sufficiently far away. Then the problem becomes fairly easy.
But there's a problem there that yes. You have, if the surface is very big, it may include the energy momentum of the field itself.
Exactly. So you don't want to actually make it too big. In fact, what you can show is the following. You'll get the same answer no matter where you choose the surface, which is what it should be. As long as the surface is not so big that it creates other stuff, too much of other stuff. As long as that's true, it actually doesn't matter where you put the surface. But to simplify your calculation, to make it easier for you to calculate things, you want to make it somewhat big so that weak field and so on. But you don't have to. That's the point. It shouldn't matter. It's a purely mathematical device, so it shouldn't depend on where you choose the surface.
But you agree that this field is extended in a space, even though your object is localized.
Yes.
So you are, there is no well-defined energy momentum tensor, because the bigger your space is, the bigger is the stuff in it.
So you don't want to choose your sphere that's so big that the contribution to the mass from outside the object is comparable to the object itself, basically.
That's the concept, you're right.
Just choose your sphere to be not that big anyway.
Nicely apart from the particles of singularity.
Sorry? Particles of singularity. In fact, that's their motivation. They were worried that, if I have a test particle, it's really a singularity. So how should it really move? So they were trying to address that question. And they basically use this trick to get around it.
Morrison proved that there is a singularity moves a lot of your tests in the paper after this.
Right. So it's a very nice trick. And by the way, of course, the surface doesn't even have this very big ambition. And you can do the same thing in Jordan frame, in case you wonder about it. Because it's really in Jordan frame where the question seems very peculiar. One would think everything is just moved on geodesics in Jordan frame. And therefore, screen and unscreen objects, if they both move on geodesics in Jordan frame, they should fall the same way. But that's not true, actually. So the question is most confusing in Jordan frame. But you can apply the same calculation when you want to. Of course, the answer is very interesting, where the two objects move at the same rate. And this is just to emphasize the point I made earlier. If you choose the surface sufficiently far away from the object, but not so large that includes too much stuff, then you are in the weak field regime, and so you can just use the usual weak field expression for the T-mu for the gravity. And then and you can bypass all consideration of same forces of the object. Okay, so without going into the calculation, let me give you a summary. So, what you find if you do the calculation, I give you a Jordan frame summary. Because in a sense, that's closer to what we actually like to think in terms of observations. The Newtonian limit, if you like, of the equation motion becomes mass times acceleration is equal to the same as times the gradient of the gravitational potential with an extra factor. Without this extra factor, it's the same thing as saying your object moves on geodesic. This extra factor in general differs from unity, and that is the equivalent temporal violation. And this factor here contains two numbers. Epsilon here is more or less either 1 or 0. 1 for unscreened objects, and zero for screen objects. And again, when I say unscreened, I mean an object with a very shallow gradient intensity. Screen means an object with a deep gradient intensity. And alpha here, as I said before, is the coupling between between phi and matter. So alpha is basically just this point. If you look at the action, the interaction between matter and the scalar field, it's basically alpha times the scalar field. Let me put the ground mass and p. So this alpha is the dimensionless coupling. Generically, you expect to be order one. For point of reference, we'll, for anybody who cares about f of r, alpha is 1 over root 6 there, that particular theory. And if you put in 1 over root 6 here, you can see this factor becomes 4/3 or 1, depending on whether the object is green or unscreened. In other words, in Jordan frame, the gravitational mass, which is this mass, m times the square bracket, and the inertial mass, which is this mass, are not equal, and the difference is again order 1 generically. Because this coupling, we expect absent symmetry should be this big one. Yeah. Thanks. So that's a Jordan frame prediction. Interestingly, you ask the same question, well, what about the other screening mechanism, the Einstein mechanism? Basically, a mechanism where you screen by a derivative cell interactions, the scalar field. There, interestingly, it turns out there's no such order one violation. It doesn't happen. And it appeared it's because of this magical shift symmetry that that was alluded to earlier, that the equation of motion for phi, if you write down the equation of motion of phi, I take DGP as an example, it has this form. It's the divergence of the current equals the source, rho. And in the case of DGP, the current is basically something that looks like this. And the point is this. It appears because of the shift symmetry, in fact, the equation of motion for the scalar field has the form of basically Gauss law, has the form of conservation. And that conservation actually forbids the kind of charge renormalization that happens to you. So interestingly, in something like DGP or something that's screened by strong coupling in general, there's no order one violation of the principle. That being said, however, there's still order one of a C squared effect. So the original not bad effect that I talked about earlier is still there. So screening by Weinstein mechanism has the same size of the equilibrium violation as basically regular principle. With no potential. Order one of the C squared. So the equilibrium principle violation is much more dramatic with the chameleon screening. So in the last two or three view graphs, I want to show you basically observations, observational tests. Well, how do you test these? Let me just go straight, if I actually ask the question, unfortunately the x-axis didn't show, the x-axis is this this number, is this point of view. Phi over alpha is the x-axis. The y-axis is alpha, is the coupling. This is the y-axis. And what I want to show is currently, basically, and everything in the shaded region is rough. It's constrained by observation. And let me tell you just roughly this schematic. Let me tell you roughly where the constraints come from. First of all, let's say alpha is order 1. Then you have to demand that something like a Milky Way must be screened. Otherwise, you violate basically constraints from solar system test by law. And so you want to demand that the Milky Way is screened. And demanding the Milky Way is screened is the same thing as saying that I want this parameter, phi over alpha, to be smaller than the gravitational potential of the Milky Way, which turns out to be, in dimensions, which is 10 to the minus 6. Yes? This number is basically more or less V over C squared. Right? And the velocity, rotational velocity of the Milky Way is about 300 kilometers. So 10 to the minus 6. So for the mid range screen, fiber alpha must be actually cap must be smaller here. So this is well, this is okay. Now of course you can also evade solar system test by just making alpha very small. So if your field is very weakly coupled to matter, of course you won't see anything. And so that's why you would expect the constraint to actually curve like that, for example, it's very small. So generically that's what happens. What I want to discuss next is observational tests that at least conservatively can push this boundary on here. And probably if we work harder, can probably go for the so let me tell you those observational tests. Yeah.
Isn't this sort of our gravity theory highly unstable?
Highly unstable. Depends on your form of F.
Most of them are.
A lot of them are. And I'm not a big fan of them either. that's probably the reason why actually nobody in this conference are right now. However, I should say this is more general than I thought. This any scalar tensor theory that's framed by community. I'm not talking about F of R. F of R is a very special example. F of R has alpha this value for the balloon 6. Generically, alpha should just be 1.
People construct a sun.
Yes.
These F of R theories, and it shines for 10 to the minus 26 centimeters, 6 seconds.
Yes.
I checked it.
Yes.
This is not good.
Uh-huh. These are the current observations. As far as I know, with the data that that people have checked currently, any point out here is fine. With observational tests for scalar tensor theory, that's screened by Kamin.
So what you're talking about is really special to F of R. So with Kamin potentials, the general that line is taken up is completely fine.
Yes.
It's really specific to the to the funny potential that you get in F of R.
Yes.
More generally.
Yes. Yeah, for various reasons, people choose. And these high order tensors.
You don't have to worry about stability of these theories.
You're right.
I mean, many are unstable, but you know, the point is they're just boring.
What's boring?
F of R.
I think it's boring.
That's just boring. It's
there must boring. Be 1,000 papers published on it.
Yes. Well, it's
being that you know, right? What can I say? You know?
Okay, I think that's
it. No, all right, let the speaker continue.
Right. Okay, I think that's enough said about it. let me tell you about the observational test. I would divide the test in two kinds. One is using galaxies as test objects, so bulk motions of galaxies. The other is using the internal motions of objects within galaxies, like stars and gas. So let me give you a first example. So if I take a small galaxy, like a dwarf galaxy, and a massive galaxy like Milky Way, or even more massive, and elliptical galaxies, if what I say is correct, if one of them is green and the other is not, i.e. the small galaxies are green, the small galaxy should fall faster. And we should see that in observations. So we can certainly measure peculiar velocity of galaxies, and we can even divide them into small and large galaxies if you want to. The key here is to do this test avoiding overdense regions, avoiding regions where there are lots of galaxies, because those are regions that has deep potential to begin with. And so all galaxies within those regions should be screened. So we want to avoid that. Ideally, basically grouping points. Those are the places where you would actually see difference between the motions of an unscreened and small galaxies and a screened and large ones. So that's point number one. Point number two is, I think it's a very interesting fact that this effect seems to distinguish between small and large galaxies, because there's a very well-known problem that has to do with voids. It has been pointed out by Peebles for a long time. And the problem more or less is this, that if you take lambda CDM and you try to predict what is the size distribution of the voids. In general, lambda CDM predict void sizes that are actually a lot smaller than is observed. And it seems that problem is fine if you define voids by large galaxies. But it's not fine if you define voids using small galaxies. And this mechanism may be actually a way to address that, which is kind of hard to address. Basically, because small galaxies will move faster, so they stream out of voids actually faster. So maybe this is the explanation. Maybe. internal motion test, I think it's probably the easiest to carry out. Probably my observer friends, probably one of them actually have already the data to actually test this, which is this. If you take a small galaxy, you can measure rotation curves of these galaxies. And you can measure rotation curve two ways. You can measure rotation curve using the stars, like the stars in the disk of the Milky Way. Or you can measure rotation curve using hydrogen gas in the same galaxy. The hydrogen gas being so diffuse have very shallow potentials. Therefore, it's unstable. Whereas the stars being so compact would be screened. And so the velocity, rotational velocity of the stars and the hydrogen gas should just differ by all of one.
So two questions. One of them is that typically the gas and the stars are at different radius.
Yeah, you
so
want to compare them.
Gas well only a radius where the stars are no longer there.
You
have to model the dark matter to.
No, that's overlap. So what happened is typically hydrogen you can see much further out of the stars. I think that's true. On the other hand, that's certainly overlap. You know, all the way in, that's hydrogen gas. People can see all the way in as other stars. So you can just measure both. But there are actually subtleties. You have to be careful because the gas typically has very nice organized motion, basically more or less circular motion in the disk. Whereas the stars, in addition to a nice organized motion, have some random motion. So you have to be careful. And also that, so you have to be a little careful. Lastly, let me just say gravitational mass, gravitational lensing. This actually add a new twist to something that people have proposed before, that gravitational lensing mass and the mass that you estimate by looking at, again, motions of objects within the galaxies, in general, they are going to disagree. And interestingly, if what I said is correct, then the lensing mass and the dynamical mass from the start would actually agree. But then they would disagree when you use diffuse gas, small galaxies. Is it okay if I show one more? let's see. This is actually unrelated talk, but I want to just show you how good the data actually has become. There are other generic tests that in my scale I talk about this. There are other effects having to do with galaxy bias. I'm not going to talk about that, but I want to show you actually one thing. It's kind of echo what Justin said earlier about the data. This is what this is. This is an arrow from microwave background. These points are data. These lines are actually predictions from different models. The dashed line here is lambda CVM, basically. The solid line here is DGP. What DGP does, in addition to giving me an equation of state, effective version of state that differs at minus one, it also predicts an ISW effect that's larger than lambda. And so it makes basically the low multiples even higher than what you expect from lambda CDN. So it exasperates the low observed quadruple or multiple problem that we already know from lambda. And that actually, already the data is good enough to exclude at least the self-accelerating branch of DGP. It actually fit worse than lambda CDN by more than 5 sigma. And of this delta chi square, a third comes from the debuff I showed you before. About 2/3 comes from the fact that W in DGP is minus 0.8 and so on. So, Just want to re-emphasize the point, the data is gradually getting so good that we can actually contain a lot of these ideas fairly nicely. Thank you.
We have time for one urgent question.
So there are tests of fifth force based on comparing lensing mass for galaxies with the dynamical mass for galaxies.
Yes.
So then doesn't that constrain the fifth force to less than 1% or so?
Yes.
Doesn't that already tell you that on a galactic scale you cannot have resistance screening?
Yeah, usually those constraints come from objects where we have good lensing estimate, which means massive galaxies, which probably means green galaxies. And there everything should just agree. So the hard thing here is to repeat the same experiment for small galaxies. is more energy. It's hard.
And by massive, you mean different potential, right?
Some, by massive, I use Milky Way, because we know Milky Way has to be screwed. So anything more massive than Milky Way. So we, typically, Lensing galaxies are like bigger potentials, more massive than Milky Way.
Okay. And that's the dimension.